And so to frame our time together, I thought I would read Psalm 46. A small disclaimer I would like to say is that there's no happy ending to this, and so we know that this is, it's not only difficult for us up here, but perhaps difficult for you as well. Some of you know there was an earthquake, some of you know more about it as you saw photos or read articles or knew people who were in it. There are many, many complicated parts to all of our stories, and of course, our perspective is only our perspective. And mine is different than Walnut's and John's even, where we were together in the same space. And so this is not a universal account of the experience of the earthquake, but simply our account of the experience of the earthquake. And so we simply ask that you open up your hearts and minds and know that this is heavy. And we placed it here before worship on purpose, and so that when this is finished, we can move over into the Village Center and worship together. So, Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth be moved, and though the mountains shake in the depths of the sea, though its waters rage and foam, and though the mountains tremble with its tumult, there is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of the city. It shall not be shaken. God shall help it at the break of day. The nations rage and the kingdoms shake. God speaks and the earth melts away. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. Come now, regard the works of the Lord, what desolations God has brought upon the earth. Behold the one who makes war to cease in all the world, who breaks the bow and shatters the spear and burns the shields with fire. Be still then and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations. I will be exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. I invite Bill to lead us in prayer.
Let's bow our head. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this beautiful day that you have been provided for us. And we thank you for each and every one of us in this room. And we thank you for your spirit, and we thank you for your guidance every day. And we thank you for everything that you presented in our lives. And blessed this village, and bless the time we'll be sharing together, and bless those who are suffering, and bless those who are mourning still, and bless everyone who made the effort to be in your presence and doing this time, and let us open our hearts and mind to understand what your will is, and what you want us to accomplish in this place. And we pray you in the name of Jesus, forever and ever. Amen.
Now, us here, there's five of us, and we were kind of in different places, but I also want to acknowledge that there is another individual in the village who was also in the earthquake, and that is Bichimui's son, Carl. And so I want to just acknowledge that, and some of us are able to share more than others, but we lift up Carl, too, who was also in the devastation in Haiti at the time. So I'm going to pass it over to John here to start us out a little bit.
Just some very basic background stuff as to why Ben and Renee and I were in Haiti initially. We met a guy in seminary, a guy named Livingston, who's here this week. And it was a great experience. He did a type of study abroad for a semester at Warbrook Seminary, where the three of us were attending. And we hung out with him. We became friends with him. And then we went our separate ways. And he went back to Jamaica, where he was studying at the time. And I'll share a piece that's not really part of my own story, but Ben and Renee did their internship year in Lincoln, Nebraska, and were connected to a church which was connected to Hearts with Haiti, which these three beautiful individuals are a part of. And so, through that connection, they and a group of college students from the Lutheran Center at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, where Renee was serving as intern, went to Haiti with this group. And I know some of you have heard this group before, but they were staying at the three different homes of the St. Joseph's family, and they were staying at St. Joseph's itself one day, and came across, or this Haitian man came across them. It was Livingston. Sparks flew, and it was a beautiful reunion, and they asked him, how can they be part of ministry in Haiti? How can they help? And he said to come back in January. We had a January term in Haiti, in seminary, and so that's what they decided to do the following year, in the senior year of seminary. And I was just kind of pulled along for the ride. Ben and I are cousins. We did a J-term in Guyana together, our first year in seminary. Both really involved and excited about mission and what the world is holding. And so connecting with Livingston, the president of the Iglesia Tyrian de Haiti, was an amazing feat. It was a very unique opportunity to be with them. January in 2010, the church itself, the church body, was turning 1 year old. And so to be with the people of this fledgling church, which had a large history, not just a year-long history, but to really be a part of, to witness to some of these happenings was exciting. And so they had set this lay and leader and clergy school up in January 2010, and we were invited to be a part of, I guess you could consider it, the teaching faculty. It was Dr. Marcia Cox was the main instructor, and then we were kind of the filling in the gaps kind of people. And so that's what we went there to do. Is that good? That's good.
part of my purpose in going too was that we decided to stand because it's easier to hear. Okay, that's okay.
Renee?
Yes.
Do you want me to get the mic here?
No, okay. I think we can do this just fine. Thank you. So I had come to do firsthand research interviewing about what it was like to start a church in Haiti, particularly a Lutheran church, in the context of incredible poverty and foreign entities coming in, the Roman Catholic faith, some Protestant entities that were really rising up, like Pentecostals and Baptists and Adventists. And so part of my joy was to have firsthand interviews. It was like this incredible research field. I had every single lay leader and pastor in one place, and translators. And so it was very exciting and wonderful to celebrate the life of the church in that place. And so we spent that whole first week there, and then because we had connections with St. Joseph's, we thought, we're just going to go hang out with the family for a while. And that's kind of what we did. And St. Joseph's is a wonderful place to meet new people in an ecumenical setting. You have people from all over the U.S. that come and stay who are Methodist, Episcopal, Roman Catholic, you name it. And so we thought, well, we'll just kind of hook up and do whatever somebody else is doing, and if they invite us, we'll go along. And so we met this woman named Kezia Firth. And she has been a nurse in Haiti for a couple years, and she lived right kitty corner to St. Joseph's. And so we spent some significant time with her. And she invited us on January 12th, the morning of January 12th, to follow her into the ravine, one of the ravines in Port-au-Prince, to see what she does. And we thought, yeah, why not? So we went with her to the ravine, and we walked around through the very narrow streets and visited with people there and saw what she did. It was a little bit out of our comfort zone, to say the least. I mean, all this kind of medical care, and but we knew it was important, and we needed to do that. And so that was our morning of January 12th. And so as a thank you for Kez, we walked up in Penchonville to the Chinese restaurant, which was the nicest Chinese restaurant I've ever been in my life, right? I mean, it is really nice. And we were disgusting. I mean, we were dirty. I was in a bandana. We were in T-shirts. And here we are. We go in, and this is a place where you pretty much have your own waiter. And we're the only people in there besides maybe some, like, Chinese ambassadors in these really nice suits. And it was, that was uncomfortable, too. So Ben ordered Kung Pao chicken, which was his favorite. And we had a wonderful time at the Chinese restaurant. And I remember feeling really good about being in Haiti, because here we were walking by ourselves, finding our way, using Haitian currency, and just loving being among the people. And that was an incredible joy. And I remember walking up to St. Joseph's and just taking a deep breath about what a wonderful day it had been, and thankfulness to be in Haiti. And so clearly we were very dirty, so we did our bucket showers. John and Ben washed their clothes together. And our kind of routine at night was to play cards or join the boys for worship. And we got visiting with a man named Al, who was older. I think he maybe even in his 80s, 70s or 80s. And Ben and I had met him and his wife, Gail, previously in Haiti. And so Ben and I were in our room, probably about 4:45 or so, 4:40. And worship starts at 5, and so we thought, oh, let's go find John, which is what we did at that time. And we went to a place that where we mostly were, on the 4th or 5th level. I don't know how you understand your levels of your home, but 5th level-ish, what also served as the Resurrection Dance Theater floor. And we sat at a table and started visiting with Al, and that's where John was. And it was just a lovely day. I mean, looking out, and the earth started to shake. And Al is from North Carolina, and he said, oh, don't worry, we have these all the time. But here we are from North Dakota and Minnesota going, oh, God. Like, we knew exactly what it was. And, I mean, we kind of looked at each other with very wide eyes, and it just got more violent. And it was very, very loud. And I think we just really panicked, is what happened. And, you know, I remember thinking, where's the door frame, you know? And there was none. I mean, we were on a completely open floor, pillars that held up the floor. So really, there was absolutely nowhere to go. And so somehow we scattered, and I ended up right in the middle of the dance floor. And for some reason, I remember looking up and saying, if the roof comes down, I need to be between these hanging lights. And I mean, this is probably in the course of maybe 20 seconds, I would think. So it's interesting how one's consciousness goes when you're in very dangerous situations. And then I could see someone kind of out of the corner of my eye to maybe about where the exit sign is, and I noticed that it was John. And then I was thinking, well, where's Ben? And I turn, and I think we're kind of in a triangle, maybe 10 to 15 feet from one another, I think is where we ended up. And Ben was hugging a pillar in the middle of the floor, and I noticed his eyes were closed. And I thought, well, that's really smart, because that pillar will hold. And so I was thinking, well, we should be where Ben was, but then the shaking just got more and more violent, and the concrete started falling down, and I just remember seeing some pieces of concrete fall on Ben's head, and I yelled for him, and he wasn't responding, and so I tried to run towards him to pull him where I was, and that's when everything just shook so violently, I think, of the ceiling, everything, two floors of concrete and a roof fell on us, and fell directly, really directly on Ben. And I remember looking up and seeing the ceiling and just thinking, this is, you know, we're dead. And was knocked over. I mean, I don't really know what happened. My glasses were knocked off, and so it was very frustrating for me because I couldn't see for a few days. and everything kept shaking, and there was dust everywhere. And when everything settled, we were in this very small space. There were a couple pillars that held on one end of the floor. And so the kind of ceiling came down like this, and about this is where Ben was. And so it was probably about this much space, like from here to here. It kind of ended up holding it high enough where John and I weren't crushed, and we were kind of parallel to each other, and I could kind of hear him moving around, and so we were able to call to one another and find each other. And there, I mean, it's hard to describe the noises of the earthquake. I mean, very loud car horns, people screaming. I mean, I distinctly remember a woman screaming out, and I had no idea what happened all around the building. I just knew our building fell. But we knew that the floors below us hadn't collapsed yet. And we were trapped. And then I thought, we're going to suffocate. it was very dusty. It was getting dark. Aftershocks kept happening. And we just kind of stayed where we were because we couldn't find our way out. And so John and I still were kind of separate. But he had found a large enough hole where we could climb out, except it was blocked by a bee's nest. And so we couldn't get out that way. I mean, eventually I think we would have had to, but so I tried a different way to go up through a hole that I'd seen, but I got my shoulders up and through, but I got stuck with the rebar and everything, and I couldn't get out. Then I was stuck, and so I worked my way back down into the space, and there was maybe a hole about this big in one of the parts of the wall, so like two beams held, and then there was maybe this much more space, give or take, to a room. And so we just started clawing out, and this whole time we were calling for Ben and looking for him, and there was no way to get to him or see him. So I thought, we have to get out, so maybe he's on the other side or somewhere where I can't see. And so we started kicking and clawing out the concrete, which was damaged enough for us to do so. And we got out onto the roof. And so it was a freestanding building, and there was no way to get down or anything. And so we went back up on the roof, and I went all around trying to find Ben. And there was just no possible way. I went to every corner, and aftershocks would happen, and we kind of cling, just kind of kneel on the roof and wait for it to collapse, really. And looking upon the city of Port-au-Prince, it was just a cloud of dust. And I mean, it really was like the world was ending, and did end. Anyway, the world as I knew it ended, and trying to comprehend what was going on, comprehend Ben's probable death, and the impossible situation that it was. And I remember this helicopter buzzing around, and I'm going, our families are going to see this, and going, I mean, just this chain of events that was so difficult. And then we saw Al, and I have no idea where he ended up, but he was very bloody, his head and his arms, and he kind of went down to where we crawled out and said, I hear him. And I don't know how much longer after the earthquake this was. I'm guessing maybe an hour. I mean, it was about dark. And so I ran down to where we were, and I was going to crawl in, but maybe Wallace, I don't even know who was on the other, the art building. My boss, I know for sure, but people were yelling at me from rooftops. People were yelling at me from buildings saying, no, Renee, like, no, don't go in there.
There was some of the children's from the
Yeah, and so I kind of just stuck my head in to listen, and I didn't want to interrupt him, and so when he was singing, what I had come to find out about a month later, the Lamb of God from Setting 10, and we've been singing it on Bible study in the mornings, and so what I heard him sing was, O Lamb of God, you bear the sin of all the world away, eternal peace with God you made, God's peace to us, we pray. And his voice, I'm surprised I could hear him because of the concrete. I mean, there was just masses of concrete on him. And from what I saw, everything landed on his head and came down onto him. And so I don't understand Ben's singing. I still don't. And I called. I knew he'd want to know that me and John were okay. And so I said that we were all right. And I said to keep singing so I could keep looking for him. And I listened, and there was nothing more. And so I said I loved him. And that was it. And so we never saw Ben ever again. And so we're on the roof, and these... I don't even remember who exactly, but got a ladder onto Kez's house, the house next door, and from her rooftop up to where we were. And so they said we had to get off the roof. And as you can imagine, I didn't really want to go anywhere. And but they said we could come back in the morning. And so we got off the roof, and down onto Kez's roof, and then down onto the street alleyway. And that is what my greatest memory of Wellness, actually, because he was the first to kind of embrace me when I got down into the alley, and I just wept on Wellness. And then aftershocks kept happening, and the stones from the walls started falling in onto us, and so we ran together up into the vacant lot. And during the whole time, I remember people saying, have you seen Bill? And we said, no, we haven't seen Bill. And they were getting, like, T. Patrick was stuck, and they were getting, I mean, so some of the boys were in the rubble, and so people were trying to get the boys out, and this is through all these aftershocks. And so we eventually made our way up to this vacant lot where people were starting to gather, and I would guess maybe about 300 Haitians were there in that space. So I'm going to maybe let John just take over for a little bit here.
You know, I like Renee was saying, there's not a lot of happy endings that we can see every day. But one of the glimpses of hope that we did have that was amazing was the power of the people gathered in that lot that night. I mean, it was 300-400 people. I don't know. It was a very small lot with many, many people. You could hear the screaming continue as people around us would die. And but the distinct thing that really stood out was the voice of people singing. And it, especially this one woman who sang all night. And we didn't sleep, obviously. And merci, Seigneur, and just praying to God continually. And I mean, there was preaching. People would sing, and then someone would stand up and preach. Then they would sing and sing and sing. And Bill can tell his story too. But they did find Bill, and he was alive, very hurt. And that's another very distinct part of the night. they found a mattress, and Bill was on that mattress all night, and we didn't know what would happen to him, and the two of us laid there and didn't sleep. And I'll always remember the generosity of, I mean, we're two white people, and maybe there were a handful of white people in a group of all these Haitians, and I remember some people who lived nearby getting a sheet and giving it to us that we could cover ourselves and have some sort of warmth. I just remember being very cold. We were in shock, and when the sun sets, it cools down. And so in terms of those first few hours, I always remember the singing. You know, I always remember the generosity of the Haitian people. And you could hear the aftershocks, as Renee was saying, continued, and you could hear the buildings continue to crumble and fall around us. And we just waited for dawn. And when the first light appeared, we ran back to St. Joseph's and went back on the roof and searched again. Especially Renee looking for him, and people helping us to do that, even though it was very unsafe and we didn't know what was happening. We searched for him, and we never saw him again. And we knew we couldn't dig him out with the concrete so much. We knew we needed help, and we knew we needed machinery. At least that's what we thought. And so we talked with Michael, and he said, "You have to go to the embassy." So that's what we did. And another gracious angel of God was with us, Wynald, a boy that is around and sells art and other goods at St. Joseph's. And he found us a taxi motorbike to take to the embassy, which was 7 miles away. The American Embassy, and he rode it there, and it ran out of gas. He found us another one, rode that one until we made it. Four of us on that bike, and it was so very bittersweet to see the embassy without a scratch and without a mark of earthquake, whereas the rest of the city was in shambles. And people were lined on the streets, some dead, some alive. The hospital we went by the courtyard was filled with people. And we were weaving down the mountain on those taxis. And ultimately arrived at the embassy. Ben was the first American reported missing. We thought we had hope in that. We thought that they would generate help for us, and instead we waited and waited as the embassy filled with hundreds and hundreds of people. We went out to check on Wynald, who was waiting for us, and told him we wanted to go back, but he wouldn't let us. He said, what will you do? You'll sleep on the streets, you'll have no water, no food. And he made us stay. And we, another chance encounter of God at work was a group of Americans that we met at the embassy who embraced Renee, we were both just very distraught and weakened. They embraced us. They read us Psalm 46. They spoke of God's love for us. They were a group of a medical mission team from New Jersey. And so we passed the days helping There's no medical team at the embassy, so this team took the place, and we had two doctors, and so we would transport people to helicopters and stay with them and pray with them and be with them. And it was very, very difficult transporting them out, because you'd go to this field where choppers would land and load a few Americans and take them away as the field was encircled by Haitians. I remember the 24-hour mark. I remember the 48-hour mark, and coping with the realization that Ben was dead, hoping for it by then. He would not have suffered. Not knowing what to hope for anymore, still searching for hope and help. And I don't remember much of in our departure. I mean, we took some sleeping pills to try to sleep. And we awakened in the middle of the night. And they had a Marine flight. They said, no one can know about this. This team has been helping out with medical work at the embassy. And they have embraced you, and that you are on the list. We need to go right now. We were loaded into Suburbans, taken to the airport, flown to Puerto Rico. And it was very difficult to get on the plane and to... To leave him there. To leave the people. As we flew away in our privilege, we had been in conversation. Texting was working. We had been in conversation with our family via text and Rafael Apica, ELCA. And Louis as well, and Raphael. And they convinced us that we had to leave, and that we couldn't help by staying there, and that it was a burden to stay, and we needed to return. So, if without that, I would never have been able to get on the plane. And it was painful, it was... To return to the United States as two instead of three. And to be embraced by our family in Minneapolis as we arrived. I don't know if you want to share about the recovery.
You know, I think me and John have different, kind of the same experience, but different noticings of things that have happened. And this moto taxi, I mean, there were four of us on one little motorcycle kind of barreling down the mountain and just seeing the destruction. I remember seeing this woman with maybe a husband or a boyfriend, and I just remember thinking, lucky, you know. But then I looked closer, and she had this huge chunk out of her ankle, and I remember thinking, you will die if you don't get help. Because she would be at a place where her leg would either need to be amputated or something would happen to her. And then I remember checking myself, going, oh my gosh. Renee. You know, like, I just remember seeing those little things, and you know how you can't help how thoughts come into your mind. And I remember walking past, you know, John said there are just people, lines of people laying on the ground, and I remember there was this white woman in a tank top just laying there, and I remember just thinking how incredibly burnt her skin will be however long she lays there. And we remember just seeing people standing helplessly outside of buildings, collapsed buildings, just kind of looking on helplessly because no one could do anything. And there was this man we met at the embassy, kind of looking exactly for what we were looking for, help. He was a Haitian who was living in the United States and had finally come back to visit his parents and brought his two children, a boy and a girl, 8 and 9 years old. And they were in the house, and it collapsed, and he was outside of it, and he was looking for help, for somebody to help get his children out. And I thought, how can we have priority over this man or over every other Haitian who has lost somebody? And I think it was in that moment of, you know, John speaks about, you know, our privilege of somehow getting us out of Haiti and feeling guilty about that and horrible about that, and also recognizing our responsibility to our families. But in the sense of why do we think that it was any more important to get Ben out than that 8 and 9 year old of those children? And I think at the embassy we just kind of said, this is it. Everybody is in the same boat. No one is getting special treatment or help other than we were able to leave. And John said that we wouldn't have been able to leave if it was not for this group that we connected with. We're in very, very rough shape, as you could imagine, and able to get a text message to our parents, which unfortunately was the way that they heard. I think the text was, Ben is dead. What do we do? Because we didn't know how long the texting would last, and so, you know, I remember hearing from my dad, who is this? And I said, this is Renee. Call Ben's parents, we can't leave without their permission. And of course, their immediate answer was, you must evacuate. And then Raphael Melpica texted and said, we will send LWF people in the morning, we will take care of Ben. And that was why I was able to leave, because I entrusted Ben to, first of all, the St. Joseph's family, who I knew would never abandon Ben, and also to the church. And we were able to leave. And so it's very difficult. And it took 3 weeks to get Ben's body out, which is even a miracle that we do have him out. In all of this, we are trying to think of a way back into Haiti. After all of this, John and I were going to have a plane to go back with Raphael, but we couldn't get permission to land. And so we thought, how are we going to do this to get Ben's body out, you know, in not 3 to 5, 6 months or a year or never? I mean, there were Marines that went there, U.S. Embassy people, and the building was far too dangerous to dig. And they kind of said, maybe if ever will you get Ben's body. And so that is when Raphael turned to Louis Dorvilliers and Mitch Dorvilliers, who are Haitian, who did not return to their country for 10 years until the earthquake. And they have all kinds of family and friends who were affected by the earthquake, killed. And Louis said that he went on the roof of St. Joseph's and prayed and just said, we're not leaving Haiti without Ben. And so hired a couple structural engineers to shore up the building, and hired a local crew of Haitians around the neighborhood. And I know Wellness was there the whole time, and so was Mitch during this, and Louis too, in between his meetings. And they took 3 whole days in an incredibly dangerous situation and dug Ben out with hammers and chisels by hand. And then they so graciously had Ben in a body bag and led him out off the roof with candles and into an ambulance that took him to the only standing mortuary there. And then I didn't know where Ben's body was, and nobody did, and he didn't show up at the embassy. And so then I thought, after all this time, his body's going to be lost. And after some phone calls and a lot of grace, there was this man named Paul from the U.S. Embassy who personally paid over $900 to get Ben's body released from the mortuary, and went and made sure that it was Ben's body that got taken to the embassy, and then flown to Dover, Delaware, to a military base, did an autopsy, and then finally back to Minnesota, and we were able to bury him on February 6th in Decorah, Iowa. And so the impossibility of Ben's body coming back, and even that quickly, is I know is nothing short of a miracle, and is a coming together of all these people. And this whole time I was in contact with Renee and Michael, and they were constantly saying, don't worry, like, we're looking out for Ben, don't worry. And that was such a wonderful reassurance for me and our family. And so, I mean, the greatest gift and hospitality had been given to us by the church and by the St. Joseph's family, by the Derviliers. There is no greater love, I think, of the risking of life to be hospitable to us so that we can visit Ben's body where he is. And so just an incredible coming together of people in particular, and knowing that we could have been in a mass grave, and where many, many, many people are. And that is an incredible injustice in all of this. And so that is even some of our story. There are many more other pieces to it, but I want to just give Wellness, Bill, and Renee some time to share some of their perspective too.
I remember on the day of the January 12th, I remember I saw Renee and John up the hill with Kes, and then they asked me, Bill, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to get a ring for my wife. They said, oh, are you getting married? And I said, yes, yes. I said, no, are you kidding us? I said, no, I'm going up to Petroville, getting a ring for my wife, I'm getting married. I said, no. And I said, where are you guys going? He said, well, we're going up to Petroville, maybe to the Chinese restaurant. And then I said, no, I'm just kidding. So I remember I didn't go to St. Joseph, but I went on Delmas because there was a lady, a Haitian lady, that I'm helping with a house that in Delmas 5. And then I'm just looking at my watch because I have to do the prayer at 5 o'clock. And then I left early. I took a motorbike and then I made it to St. Joseph. So normally I ring the bell at St. Joseph's at 4:45, so I give all the kids a time so we can start the prayer at 5 o'clock. But in my head I think, well, Ben and Rene, John, they in the way, they'll be coming. I know they'll be participating in the prayer with us, because every time we have prayer in the evening, they're always there with us. And then said, well, maybe they're in the way, or maybe they're somewhere around the house. And then I went up on the sixth floor and then to ring the bell. Normally, I just ring the bell without thinking anything. And then when I got up there, and then here is the bell, and I had the piece of rebar to ring the bell. And I stopped. Normally, I just ring the bell. I stopped. And then I paused for a second. And I heard some noise up on the roof, and I went up on the roof. And when I got up on the roof, there were 5 kids playing games. And I told them, you guys have chores to do downstairs. You go and finish your chores before I ring the bell. You know, as a good parent, right? So they went downstairs, and then I remained up on the roof. Because I know my kids. As soon as I go downstairs, they go right back up to finish the game. And I remain up there to make sure nobody went back on the roof. And I'm just staying up there. And then and suddenly, the building started to shake. I said, God, what is this? And automatically, I said, okay, the kids are downstairs, but where are the others? And the building is shaking. And I've never been to an earthquake before. I didn't know anything. So what I did, there is nothing came to my mind to run. And I I stay up there and I hold on to the railing. And then the only thing I remember that I said, God, my life is in your hands and do your will. And then the 3-4 collapsed. No fire. I didn't know how I landed, but I was there for a while. I was unconscious for a long time. Somehow, when I came to my senses, I felt my packet is vibrating. My packet is vibrating. And I reached my packet, and it was my cell phone. And then someone called me. And then that was Jeff Day, who was his cousin. He was downtown when that happened. He couldn't go up, so he was stuck. And then he'd been trying. We have 3 different cell phone companies, and we have GZCell, Voila, and Itel. Itel is the local cell phone company. So the Itel doesn't give you good service. And when Voila came, and when GZCell came, and then in the business, a lot of people abandoned Itel and they jump into Voila and GZCell. And then a lot of people said, Bill, why are you still stuck up with this company? You don't receive any good service. I said, well, I'm faithful. I know they'll be good. I'm going to stick up with Itel. And then guess what? On that day, the only cell phone company that you can find service of is Itel. It's Itel. And I the last word I remember, I said to Jeff Day, please, go and tell them I'm alive. I was in this big yard, and then I have a lot of wobbles on the top of me. I couldn't move. And full of dust and blood. And then I tried to manage myself because all this part was numb. I couldn't do anything. So I tried so hard. And then later on, when I woke, and then guess what? I landed on a chicken. And that was Wallace's chicken. That Wallace brought. And then when he went to the countryside to visit his parents, and then, you know, when you go to the countryside, your parents are so happy. They're happy to see you. And sometimes they give you a chicken. They give all of us a chicken. And for some reason, the chicken died before and the day of the earthquake. And then, before the earthquake. And then Wellness asked one of our boys to throw it away. And then guess what? And then one of our boys threw it to one of the neighbor's yard. When I landed in Wellness. I said, the cushion. And then when I land, that was Wellness's chicken. So, and here I am. So here I am, and then there was 2 dogs that came and attacked me. And then here I am, like, these dogs are like, went crazy. And then I was like this, and I have no way to defend myself. And then finally the dogs left me alone. And then I can hear a lot of crying. And then the kid, help, help, help. And I couldn't do anything. I couldn't do anything. And then while I was on the ground, I said to God, God, please keep me alive so I can be a witness. Because I don't know how many people in the building survived. And then after a while, there was a guy, he came around the house, around in the backyard, and he saw me lay there. And then he went out. And then afterward, he came back with a lady. And I was the owner of the house. And then she said, Make sure this guy get him out of my yard. I don't want anybody to die in my yard. And she's a doctor. She said, I don't want anybody to die in my yard. Make sure this guy get out of my yard. And then somehow, the guy managed to go up somewhere and then said, there was a guy that can't even move. And then I think Wellness and others, and then they can, and then dug me out. And then took me to the empty lot, which became the refugee camp for the whole community. Kez, Rene mentioned, she was the only one taking care of 100 people in that day. And a lot of them didn't make it. But when I got to the field, and Kez helped me out and then gave me some medicine, and then probably she gave me some Vicodin, and I was knocked out. I didn't remember anything at all. And then the next day, the two guys came with a tap-tap, like a pickup truck, and then they have a plywood, and then they put me on the plywood and slide me in the top tap, and they went to several hospitals, and then they said they can't take any people. They can't take enough, it's not enough, a room. And then they went to several places, and then they said, well, we'll take you up to the mountain where Wings of Hope is. So it was myself and Patrick, little Patrick, so he was the one who got trapped, and they have to pull him out, put a ladder up to pull him out. And then he was on the bench, and I was on the floor. So while we were going up there, and we went out of gas. And it was hard, no food, and I was in agony. And then I don't know what the injuries are, but I couldn't move. And then somehow one of them, they left us there, and then they walked, and then filled up 2 gallons, and walked back. And then they filled up the tank, and then they took us there. So when I got there, and then one of the doctors said, we have no more space. And then I remember there was one of our kid who goes to St. Joseph's that work at Wings of Hope. And he said, please, please do something. And then he's one of us. Please help him. And then they said, we have no room. And then they have a hallway, and then they put me in the hallway. And then Kez left her house and went up there and then spent the night with me along with Jeff Day. So the next day, I said to them, well, I want to go back to St. Joseph's. I want to go back. They said, no, you can't go back. The home is not exist. I said, what do you mean is not exist? Where is everybody? And I started to name something. Where is Wayne Ben? I know I was with those people. And the previous day, I said, where is everybody? They said, they're not there. I said, are they dying? And then they said, well, Ben. I said, what? I said, where is Rene? Where is John? And then they said, well, they went to the embassy. And I said, where are all the kids? And they said, well, they're still on the field outside. I said, and I said, well, take me to Wings of Hope. I know Wings of Hope was next door. I said, take me to Wings of Hope. But I had no idea if Wings of Hope was severely damaged. And then when I got up there, and I saw all the kids in the wheelchair crumble in the one womb. And then, well, those guys were carrying me. And then I looked in the room and all these kids were crumbled up. And a lot of the kids on the wheelchair, they remembered me. And then and some of them said, oh, and then they started to cheer up. They saw me. And then I said, I need to go to St. Joseph's. They said, Bill, you can't go to St. Joseph's. But in my head, the fourth row still standing, and then we will be able to leave and the rest of the house. So they took me to St. Joseph's. When I got to St. Joseph's, and then I said, oh my Lord. And then I saw Michael sitting like this. So around the rubble, and then looking. And then Michael, he's a guy that he always managed to put some beauty in a place. Around the rubbles, Michael already put plants that he retrieved from the roof, put plants and he put a cooler, and then Michael gave me a cup of water and said, Bill, welcome. Welcome home. And I just look around. And then I said to Michael, where is everybody? And Michael just got back from his father's funeral. And then we've been working so hard and getting ready to celebrate the 25th anniversary. And Michael got back on the 6th, on the 12th, the earthquake. So after 4 days later, and then Michael said, Bill, you have someone coming to pick you up. I said, where? I said, well, you have a friend coming to pick you up. I don't know where they're coming from. But in my head, I said, well, they are coming from the countryside. And then later on, Kez packed my bag because I couldn't even move. So Kez have to clean, like, put new clothes on me and everything. And then I got on the bus, and they said, Bill, you have a plan coming at 1 o'clock, picking you up. I got on the bus, and then they took me to the airport. While riding on the bus, I saw all the dead bodies on the street, and dogs started to eat the bodies. And then when I get to the airport, I collapsed. And then I see myself that I have a way out. Who's going to take care of those people? And what about the St. Joseph family? What about Ben? I mean, what about... And at the time, I didn't know if Renee and John already left. I thought they're still around. I said, where are they? And then... So when I got to the airport, I was collapsed, and then Ben, his name is Benjamin Skinner, he's the guy that wrote the book, The Crimes of Monstrous, and then he came down there with Miles Wright, and Miles Wright, he was the treasurer for Hudson Heath, and then they went down there and then to rescue me. And when I got to the airport, and then they put me on a table, and then they gave me some morphine, and then and put me in an IV. So I didn't know when I got on the plane. So when I woke up and I saw myself in the in Panama, I said, "Where are you?" They said, "Well, we have to go there so we can check the passports." And then they took me to Fort Lauderdale. So when I got to Fort Lauderdale, and they took me to a hospital. So when I got to the hospital and they washed, and then the doctor was taking, who put me in, and then he started to scream, "Oh, guys, come and see this! Come and see this! Come and see this! They tried to kill this guy!" And I said, "Oh, what's
going on?
And then the needle they put in my arm, it was long. It was that long. And then they put it in. And the guys put it out. He said, guys, look at this. They're going to kill this guy. I said, oh, what's going on? They said, and he said, what is your name? I said, my name is Bill. He said, you know, in America, we do things a little different. I said, well, we don't stick all this needle in your arm. We're going to take good care of you. I said, thank you. And then he did all the checkup of the x-ray, all the CAT scan and everything. And then he said to me, you are lucky. I have been doing this for 50-some years. No one ever survived that far. You really have God in your side. And God saved your life for a purpose. And then I remember I said to him, what about the others? What about them? He said, well, you are here, and then God already take care of you. God already take care of you. And then I got in my room, and the next day, the plan was not to stay at the hospital. The next day I have to go to North Carolina, a Duke hospital. And then they put me in my hospital clothes that I never worn before. And then the nurses came, and Miles said, Bill, we have to go. And all the nurses said, no, you can't go without the doctor's order. And then they said, well, Mr. Nathan, who is this guy? I said, well, this is my brother from a different mother. They said, oh, your brother from a different mother? I said, yes. He said, Mr. Layton, you can't leave. I said, well, I'm leaving. He said, well, before you leave, you have to sign this paper. And if anything happens to you, we're not responsible. And then Miles White and us went out and asked for a wheelchair, and they won't give him a wheelchair. And then Miles went to the parking lot and saw a lady with a wheelchair, and then he asked the lady, are you using it? And the lady said, no, and then took the wheelchair. And he said, well, you think I can go to Haiti? I cannot find a wheelchair? So I got in the wheelchair, and then he said, wait here, I'll get the car. But I had two options. I can get on the car to get to Raleigh, or I can we can fly. I said, well, I think I'll be more comfortable in the car if I want to go out and use the restroom and everything, eat something so we'll be more comfortable. But in my head, I had no idea how far Raleigh to Florida. So they took the IV on, so I got on the car, I couldn't sit, and then Miles stopped somewhere and got a blanket and got a pillow, and then I got on the car, and then it took me to Raleigh. And then I had no idea what time I got there. And then and the next day, they took me to the hospital. When I got to the hospital, they did all the checkup. They said, Bill, you have a lot of internal injury. So my vertebrae, all the bones were cracked. And I had a lot of broken ribs and a lot of them floating inside. And I had bruises in my liver. The left knee, the ligaments was damaged. And then they said, Bill, for broken ribs, and we can't do anything. They have to heal by themselves. So they said, well, the good news is you don't need to have any brace in your surgery. But if they keep bothering you in the long term, we have to pull them out. So far, so good. I never had any surgery, and I've been drumming hard. And then I went back to Haiti and helped with the demolition. And then Rene and John went down there, so I've been asking about them all the time. So it was such a joy to see both of them in the same place. In the same place where we embraced each other, and then it was the best time for me. Best time for me. And then and the out super the support that I had from a lot of people around the U.S. He was amazing. It was amazing. How people were there to help us and help the family and help a lot of the Haitian people. I think I took the whole time. I don't think I gave any time for Rene and Walnut to talk. And then, so I am so happy that we shared that moment together. And then, it was hard. It was hard for us. But when I see everybody come in a group, and then by your support, and then you really supporting us, and then you encouraging us. Sometimes I feel really down, but when I look at